Welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on wisdom when we come back. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7, that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. That is a scientific statement. And it's scientific because every year the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water, about 286,000 cubic miles of water. Now, for century after century, millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea hasn't increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is that possible? Well, we call it the cycle of evaporation and precipitation. The writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came. And indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator. We call it evaporation, and they form themselves into clouds, and then they ride back to the head of their toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. Now, in the modern science of meteorology, we understand this, and its laws are now comprehended. But modern science has learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture, and it's one of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School that we conduct twice a year here at the Law School in Isabella, Missouri. For more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package first. That's the place to start. It doesn't cost anything. It's a four-hour commentary. It's a commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. You can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about wisdom. My old granddad used to call that common sense. He'd make a statement like, well, that guy hasn't got sense enough to carry guts to a barrel. And the old-timers had a level of street sense or a level of comprehension and understanding. My wife was telling me a story last night. She was talking to a young lady. Well, I say young, you know, compared to me. She, you know, most people are young. And this woman has a college degree. And her husband just died not too long ago. And so she's being thrown out onto the sidewalks of the world, so to speak. And she's going to have to make a living of it by herself. So she signed up for a real estate course, and she was telling my wife about how she'd signed up for this real estate course, and she's going to go to real estate school and learn how to sell real estate. My wife pointed out, did you hear that the real estate market here in America has tanked? It hit its peak in June of 2005. It's been declining, and it's expected to decline for at least another 18 to 36 months, and then it's going to hit bottom. Then we don't know how long it'll stay on the bottom before it begins to rebound. And that more than 500,000 real estate agents, salesmen, and brokers have terminated their employment and gone on to something else. And this woman said, well, no, I hadn't heard that. I don't know where you would be in America that you haven't heard about the housing bubble, but I guess this lady had not heard about the housing bubble. And this is another example that I use of just common sense. You know, if you need to go out and retrain yourself for another line of work, which is pretty common, if your job is being outsourced to India, if you find yourself unemployed and you're looking for a job, my suggestion, my common sense would tell me that going to buggy whip school to be trained in the manufacture of buggy whips is probably a very limited specialty. There are still buggy whip manufacturers in America, believe it or not. There are people that need buggy whips, and there are people, you know, that still drive buggies, but they're not the common and ordinary use or means of transportation in this country. And real estate's a good business. I'm not knocking real estate. I've been in it for many years, but I wanted to point out that there's cycles in it, and right now is not the time, at least in my humble opinion, to be getting into real estate. This is, you know, it's the market peaked and it's on its way down. It's in the down cycle, and there are people that are in the real estate business, been there for many, many years, and you're gonna go in here and knock heads with the pros that have been here for years and years, and think you're gonna make a living at it as a novice. Now, that's an example that I use, or that I think of when I think of common sense. You know, what would be logical for you to do at this juncture of time? Now, my old dad explained to me that there's no better way to learn than by experience. And so I've mentioned this to you a time or two. There's only two ways for us to come into the possession of this kind of knowledge. This woman either has to go out into the real estate world with her new degree from real estate school. Now, she's going to go to school, I don't know for how long, 6 months maybe. And when she gets through with real estate school, she's going to have a piece of paper. She can tack it up on her wall. And they'll say, I'm real smart. I know all about real estate. I can close deals. I can make an escrow. I know how to follow the real estate laws, one thing and another. There's no doubt about that. But the real bottom line is, well, how much money did you bring home today from your real estate sales? I mean, how many sales did you make? And how much did you get paid? And how are you using your money to pay your bills and mortgage and house payments and one thing? Well, that's what I call revelation versus experimentation. This woman's going to go out and experiment in the real estate market. I don't think she needs to do that. I think that any real estate broker, any real estate salesman who's been in the business any length of time could probably give her a couple of good pointers on, is this the right time for you to go to real estate school? Now, of course, the people in real estate school are going to tell you, this is the right time. There's no better time than today for you to go to real estate school. Well, what the hell do you think the Ford salesman's going to tell you about Chevrolet automobiles? You know, salesmen sell whatever it is that they're selling. And, you know, you should have what we call discretion, commonly known as common sense. It's in the Bible, it's called wisdom. And then apply just reason, logic, and common sense to the story that the Ford salesman is telling you about how great this Ford car is. Well, what did you expect him to do? Give you a critical critique like you would get maybe from some auto magazine that's going to tell you all the good points and bad points about this Ford car and how they tested it, you know, for 40 or 50,000 miles and found out this and found out something else. He's not going to tell you any bad things about that Ford car. He's going to tell you all the good things about it, none of the bad things. That's where discretion comes in, just wisdom, logic, and common sense. Now, you can experiment, and you know, you've got about 70 years in your lifetime, and you can go out here and reinvent the wheel over and over and over and over again, or you can go to somebody that's in the know, and you can say, hey, Bob, what do you think of this? And this is called wise counsel. Wise counsel. And I think of wise counsel as something other than my brother Bill, or my brother Jim, or my friend Tom. I think of wise counsel as being somebody who is totally disassociated with me, doesn't know me from jack squat, doesn't have any financial interest involved in this. And I walk up to him and I say, hey, can you tell me what you know about AIDS? Can you tell me what you know about the fluoride or chlorine or chloride in your water supply? And so from time to time, we make reports here on the Law Hour, an editorial review, and we talk about Homeland Security, or we'll talk about the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or the Environmental Protection Agency, or the war in Iraq, or fluoride or chlorine in your water. And we take books, and we take articles, and we take information that comes from people that are in the field. And I can't think of a better guy to go to than a real estate broker who's been in the business for a number of years, walk into his office and say, hey, look, I'm looking for a job selling real estate. And I think the guy would say, well, you want to sell real estate? Well, we sell on commission only. Okay. Now, what do you think of the market right now? Well, it's in a kind of a slump. Now, I don't know anything about selling real estate, but I'm getting ready to go to real estate school. What do you think of that? I think the guy would say, oh, you're a total novice. You've never sold real estate before. You're going to go to real estate school, get a degree, and then you're going to come back here and you want me to give you a job. Well, here's what I think. I think the guy would probably give you a pretty straight answer, you know, concerning, well, should I go to real estate school? But if you go to the real estate school salesman, he's going to say there's no better time for you to get into real estate than today, right in the midst of a slumping market. Why? Well, because he gets paid a commission for bringing students in. Now, you're going to spend the money, you're going to become a real estate agent or a real estate broker, real estate salesman, and you're going to have a degree you can put on your wall, but whether or not that's going to translate into sales, you know, that's another story. I don't know if this lady can sell or not. Maybe she's a salesman, maybe she isn't. People that don't have a knack for selling aren't going to do very well in sales, no matter what the hell they're selling. You know, there's salesmen, and then there's people that think they are, and, you know, there's businessmen, and then there's business boys. And whether you can make it in that, I don't know. I'm not here to judge. You know, the lady's, signed up, and she's going to go to real estate school. But that's the point that I'm making, is that Americans have lost their common sense. And the Bible says they have lost their wisdom. And wisdom comes from God. That's a revelation. And the guy that takes the revelation is probably a little wiser than the guy who's out here experimenting. For instance, the scripture, the number one book in the Bible about wisdom is the book of Proverbs. And wisdom is associated with witty inventions, understanding, wise counsel, instruction, justice, judgment, equity, knowledge, truth, righteousness, discretion, prudence. Those are adjectives that describe what wisdom is. You would be a knowledgeable person if you were wise. You would be a truthful person if you were wise. You would be a righteous person if you were wise. Foolishness, on the other hand, is associated with fools die for want of wisdom. It's the exact opposite. It's 180 degrees in the opposite direction. Fools die for want of wisdom. Let's see. If we were to apply that proverb to this lady who is going to go out and get a real estate license, she's going to go get a degree from real estate school in the midst of probably a real estate slump that will equal, if not surpass, the 19, the 1930s, the Great Depression years. That's what I think we're looking at right now. But now, I could be wrong. I've been wrong once or twice before in my life. It probably won't surprise me if I'm wrong again. But I look at real estate and I say, well, I don't think that's something I'd want to get involved in right at this moment in time. I think there may be something else that might be more saleable than real estate. Although, there are people buying and selling houses today. There's a few houses being bought, sold, and traded. But, when you take a look at the whole market and the number of people that are out there that you got to compete with in order to sell houses, I got to ask you, are you really sure you want to do that? All right. So anyway, you can see where we're going with this. Fools then are associated, or foolishness is associated with nonsense, with lies, with stupidity, with ignorance, with unrighteousness, without prudence. And it's devoid of justice and judgment. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. A fool is a guy that doesn't want to learn. He denies the obvious. We're instructed to forsake the foolish. Stay away from foolish people. They're not going to make you any money. And then the fool shall be servant to the wise. A companion of fools shall be destroyed. Fools mock sin. They make fun of justice and judgment and equity, which is, after all, the exact opposite to sin, which is crime, perversion, wickedness, evil. And so in our society today, we laud perversion. Homosexuality is looked upon as being a great virtue in society here. In the Bible, God says it's a perversion, and it's a capital felony, that it's wicked and evil, and don't do that. And so you got to make a choice. Everybody makes choices in life. Shall I follow the scripture, or shall I follow the society? And so most people follow the society. Well, okay. But there's no such thing as a crime without a punishment or a penalty. There's no such thing as an action without an equal opposite reaction. Now, we apply that to physics, but if you'll think about that for a moment, when you make a decision, you're driving down the street, and you're driving about 45 miles an hour going down battlefield, and you're coming up to a big intersection, and the light's green, and you're about a half a block away, and the light turns yellow. Decision time. Do I stop, or do I step on the gas, and do I whiz on through the intersection? Well, now in our town, they've put up these traffic cameras. They got cameras at the major intersections. And so as you go whizzing through the red light, it's going to turn red before you get there. But by this time, you're going to be going 55. And there's no real hazard involved. It's just that here's your decision time, and you made your decision, and then the photograph, comes down, and they send it to you in the mail, and here you are out in the intersection, the light's red, and they got your license plate number, and they send you a ticket in the mail. Okay, but it was a decision that you needed to make, and you made it. And here's the results of it. On the other hand, maybe you said, well, I think I'll slam on the brakes, and the guy behind me, I hope he can get stopped, but if he can't, he'll run into me. Okay, so then we're going to have an accident here. I don't know. It's a decision that you had to make, and then so you slam on the brakes, and maybe he hits you, maybe he doesn't, maybe things are wrong, but you saved yourself a ticket, didn't you? All right, well, that's what life is made up of. It's made up of a series of decisions that you have to make every day. Hundreds, maybe thousands of little decisions are made up by you in your lifetime. Some of these decisions are wise. Some of them are a little foolish. Some are just plain stupid. I used to be young and stupid. Some people would say, well, you're old and stupid now. Well, maybe that's true, but I have to make decisions just like you do. Everybody in life is making decisions. Now, let's go back and take a look at decisions that we made in education. Looking back about 1900, we didn't have any complaints, did we? I mean, everybody that went to school got an education. My granddad went to the 6th grade. My grandmother went to the 8th grade. It was uncommon in 1900, well, from 1880 to 1920, it was uncommon for people to go to school and get a high school diploma. Uncommon. After 1920, it became more and more common to get a high school diploma. Now, I don't know how common it is today. We have a lot of dropouts, in schools today, but moral of the story is, today, 100 years later, in the year 2000, Johnny can't read. And our test scores are low. And test scores are going down. Or they're already at the bottom, and they're just kind of bouncing along. And so, oh my God, our test scores went up this year by 5 points. And what they didn't tell you was they already dropped off 60 points. And now they came back up 5 points. And so now, what do you call this, smart? You're still down 55, aren't you? Now, you'd have to get back, American education has to get back to the level that it was in 1963 just to get back up to the waterline again. American education began declining in 1963. It is below the level of 1963, has been every year from 1963 to today, and it's getting worse, not better. That's if you take the whole average. Yeah, there's some good schools, and there's kids that score above the 1963 average today. But if you take all the children in America, they're below the 1963 level. Now, in 1900, we were spending about $50 per child. That, adjusted for inflation, that would be about $500 to educate a child in public school in 1900. But today, we spend $9,000 per child to educate a child in public school. That's 18 times more. Now, while we're spending 18 times more money 18 times more money to educate a child today. He turns out dumber than he was in 1963. And it's getting worse, not better. Now, my common sense, my wisdom, my understanding says to me, something changed about 1963. Something probably changed more like about 1953, but it manifested itself by about 1963, and it has continued to manifest itself for the last 40 years, and it isn't changing, hasn't changed, and it probably isn't very likely to change. And so now the question is, should I send my child to public school? I came to that conclusion years ago. The answer was hell no. That's crazy. Well, unless you want to dumb this kid down. I mean, if you want to turn out a fool, send him to the public fool system. You can't beat public school. Let me give you an illustration. There's three ways to educate a child. You can educate your child in your homeschooled home, which costs about $500 a year, and your child, on average, will score at the 86th percentile. And that's assuming that you don't have a teaching credential, never spent a day in college, and you educate your child at home. He'll score at the 86th percentile. If you send your child to a parochial school, that is, you pay your taxes to support the public school, then you take more money out of your pocket and send him to a private school with a certified teacher with a teaching credential, your child will score on average at the 80th percentile. That's six percentiles lower than you could do at home without a degree and without a teaching credential on average. Then you can send your kid to public school, which is what most people do. And on average, your child will score at the 50th percentile, about 60% lower than your homeschool. And the teacher, rest assured now, is going to have a piece of paper on the teacher's wall that says, I'm real smart and have a teaching credential, and I've been to college and got a BS degree. And boy, that BS degree is exactly what it says. It's BS. And they'll score at the 50th percentile, 60% less, unless they're going to an inner city public school, like New York, Chicago, Philadelphia. If they're going to an inner city public school, on average, they will score at the 28th percentile. 28. So get these four numbers down. Inner city public school, 28. Average public school nationwide, 50. Parochial school, 80. Homeschool, 86. All right, now let's apply a little wisdom to this. Assuming that you'd like your child to be educated, intelligent, smart, knowledgeable, and has some gray matter between his ears, which educational system do you think is the better choice for your child? All right, we'll give you about 5 or 10 seconds here. Go ahead and think about it. Let's run over the options again. You can send your kid to an inner-city public school like Cleveland, Ohio, and he'll score at the 28th percentile. That's about as low as you can get. Or you can send him to a really good public school in Whittier, California, and he'll score on average at the 50th percentile. Or you can send him to a parochial school, your pick, Catholic, Protestant, Jew, whatever you want. He'll score on average at the 80th percentile. Or you can educate him at home, you being a high school dropout, totally dumb, uneducated, no teaching credential, never spent a day in college, dropped out of high school in the 10th grade, and your kid will score on average at the 86th percentile. I know you're going to sit there and say to me, oh, my God, how can that be? Well, that's what I thought. How the hell can that be? All right. Now, if you said, no, I'm going to educate my kid at home, which is the logical conclusion, you're not going to like that because, see, that takes time, effort, and energy on your part. And you don't want to do that. You want to send your kid off and let somebody else do that. And that's just exactly the point. That's what we've been doing in this country. We send our kids off and let somebody else educate them. Well, the other guy that's educating your kid really doesn't care whether your kid learns anything or not. The guy who's probably the most concerned about your child's education is probably you, because I don't give a rat's, you know what, as to whether your kid is educated or not. I couldn't care less. Now, I was real concerned about my children, so I sent them to private school. I homeschooled. I did all three. I sent them to public school. I sent them to private school. I took them through homeschool. All of my children turned out to be pretty smart. They're all out making a living. They're all out doing their thing. I'm not complaining about education. I can see the deficiencies in the public school system, and I said, well, that's not for me, that's not for my kids, so I'm not going to send my kid there. So here's the options. Now, people will say, well, see, the reason that the public school system is not as good as the other two options is because the class sizes are too big and they don't have enough money. All right, let's take a look at the money. Here in America, if you send your kid to a parochial school, could be anything you want to charge, the teacher, on average, gets paid the kid that you're sending there costs, on average, $2,500. I don't know what the teacher gets paid. It's less than public school, but on average. But the kid is going to cost about $2,500 to educate in that school. So here's the Catholic school down here. They got a bunch of kids in here that are scoring at the 80th percentile, and they're charging you $2,500 to educate that kid. Over here in the public school, they're getting $9,000 to educate that kid to the 50th percentile, 60% less. And the public school apologists say, well, it's because we don't have enough money. Well, okay, well, then what you got to do in public school is to spend about twice that much, $18,000. I guess if you spend more money on a bad product, the product gets better. Somehow or another, we don't apply that to automobiles. You know, if you were to buy a Yugo and complained about it, would you think that, well, I bought this Yugo and it's a piece of trash, but I only paid $5,000 for it. So I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go out and buy another Yugo, but I'll pay $10,000 for it. And if I pay twice as much, it should be a better car, shouldn't it? We wouldn't use that kind of logic. We wouldn't use that kind of wisdom in buying an automobile, but we do that when we buy public school. Isn't that kind of stupid? Then they say, well, the class size is too big. When I was in public school, every child in the third grade, this is Mrs. Wilds, an old lady. She was about 63, as I recall, when I was in the third grade. Mrs. Wilds had 32 children in the class. And that was two more than the room was designed for. They had five rows of six seats each. That's 30. It's designed for 30. And she had to have two seats sitting sideways in the back of the room for two extra kids that came in. That was 32. Every single one of us passed to the fourth grade. All 32 kids passed to the fourth grade. All 32 kids could do third grade work when we got through. We weren't complaining about public schools, and Johnny couldn't read in 1946, 47, 48, when I went to school. Wasn't a problem. Tis today, something changed. All right, so when we're talking about education, Americans don't seem to be able to connect the dots. That it isn't class size, and it isn't how much money you spend. You know, there's some public schools that spend $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 per student, and they're still dumber than they were in 1963. Now, I wouldn't go so far as to say the more money you spend, the dumber the kid becomes. I don't know that that's true. But I do know this. The more money you spend doesn't mean the kid's going to be smarter either. So why don't you get out there and spend more money and reduce the class size? It hasn't worked for the last 40 years. What makes you think it's going to work in the next 40? Which now brings us up to the halfway point. And let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour and the editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log, a schedule, and archives. That can be accessed through the webpage as well. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about wisdom, or in the vernacular, common sense, as my old granddad used to say. Guys ain't got any common sense. Let's take a look at insurance. We send our kids to public school, and then we go out and we buy insurance. The big mantra today among political candidates is that 46 million Americans are living their lives without health insurance. As if health insurance was as necessary as your thumb on your left hand. Now, in looking at my left hand, I can see that it's very nicely constructed, and that thumb is very important. But I don't believe that having two thumbs on my left hand would be good for me. I don't think that it would increase the utility of my hand any. I can't imagine where I would put it. Maybe if it was on the opposite side of my thumb, on the other side, I'd have two thumbs, one coming out of the palm of my hand and one coming out of the other side. You know, maybe a second thumb would be kind of handy. I'm not quite sure, but I'm satisfied with what I've got. And I don't have health insurance. And I'm one of those 46 million Americans without health insurance, and I'm working as hard as I can every day to avoid it. I'm staying as far away from health insurance as I can get. And it just scares the living hell out of me that you people are going to elect Hillary Clinton, and she says that she's going to have a mandatory health insurance program, and that I have to join up, whether I like it or not, whether I want to or not. And I guess that's because Hillary's smarter than I am, and I never denied that. That woman's no dummy. And I'm sure that she's a whole lot smarter than I am. But I'd like to live my life myself. I'd really rather that she just lived her life and let me live my life. But politicians, they want to live their lives and they want to live your life too. Most Americans are satisfied with that. I'm not. And that's where the conflict comes in. I don't want health insurance. Now, it may be because I'm very wise, or it may be that I'm very dumb or foolish or nonsensical. Now, remember, we took a look here from the biblical point of view. A fool now is somebody who despises knowledge, wisdom, and instruction. Well, I got a little instruction in the insurance business when I trained years ago, kind of like the lady that I'm telling you about earlier in the program. I trained as an insurance adjuster, you know, when I was a youngster, years and years ago. Then I never really got into the insurance adjusting field after I spent my money and went to school and became an insurance, but I learned a lot. Oh, God. Yeah, I learned the insurance business. I found out what a corrupt piece of trash that really, really is. So let me give you a few of the numbers here. Now, Americans believe in insurance. I mean, Americans believe in insurance like they believe in Christmas, which I already covered a couple of days ago. I said, I'm not really quite sure why we want to practice Christmas, but we do. And I'm not really quite sure why it is we want to practice insurance, but it certainly is true that we do, because most Americans have insurance. Now, if you don't have health insurance, you got auto insurance. And if you don't have auto insurance, you've got fire insurance. And if you don't have fire insurance, you've got, you know, some other form of insurance. I mean, insurance is the American way. I don't have any insurance at all. I don't have any fire insurance on my house. I don't have any auto insurance on my car. I don't have any health insurance to, you know, in case I have a catastrophic illness like cancer or heart attack. I don't have any insurance. None. Zero. Zilch. And I'm avoiding it. I mean, if you came up and you said, Gordon, I want to pay your health insurance premiums, I'd say, get out of here, Bob. Leave me alone. No, don't do that. And so I guess you got to ask, well, what the hell's the matter with you, Gordon? Is something, you know, you got your head up the wrong end again? Well, let's take a look at auto insurance over here. There was a time in America when auto insurance was not mandatory. Today, it's mandatory. Now, auto insurance is good for some people. I'm not sitting here saying that auto insurance is bad for everybody. It's real good for the auto insurance salesman, claims adjusters, the auto insurance industry as a whole, the thousands of employees of auto insurance companies, the executives and the management and the chairman of the board of directors and the board of directors. I mean, there's lots of people that make a lot of money off of insurance. And I don't blame them. And, you know, everybody's got a mortgage and a house payment to make, and they got car payments, and they got wives to feed and kids to educate and send to college and one thing and another. And some people make their livings, you know, as plumbers, carpenters, electricians, insurance salesmen. But if you take a look at the overall insurance industry, and then let's take one of them. Let's just take auto insurance, for instance. Everybody's supposed to have auto insurance. And we take a look at it. What do you think is the actual average payment that you're making in this country for auto insurance? What's the average? Well, the average is $800 a year. Well, what do you get for your $800 a year? Well, you get protection up to a certain limit. Could be $50,000. Could be $100,000. $200,000. Depends. But on average, you've got whatever your state's minimum is, and maybe you want it a little bit more, and you've got that minimum, cost you $800 a year. In some states, it'll be a little less, and some states, it'll be a little more. In Los Angeles, California, the average is $3,500 a year. Just thought I'd point that out to you, in case you didn't know. A lot of people pay a lot of money for their auto insurance, and some people pay a little bit less. One guy in New Jersey that I heard of, this is a pretty extreme case. Now, this isn't the average, this is just an extreme case. In New Jersey, has a wife and three daughters. They have three cars and pay $7,000 a year in auto insurance. A man and his wife and three daughters, all of them driving cars. They have a family policy, $7,000 a year. Now, these three daughters are all under age 25, and so that's what boosts his average way up. All right, now, what happens if you have an automobile accident? Well, the insurance company comes in, we presume, and pays the damages. Now, if you have a $100,000 claim, let's suppose you go out and you have a wreck, and you have $100,000 worth of damages out here, what do you think the insurance industry, on average, how many of those claims do you think they pay? 90%, 95%, 98%? The answer is 9. 9% is what they pay. And anything that costs $100,000 or more, the insurance company will litigate. That's the bottom line. So if you think you're going to get paid for a claim over $100,000, go down and talk to the Hurricane Katrina people, and they'll tell you very plainly, getting paid by the insurance company isn't what it's advertised on TV to be. All right, so that's number one. Number two, the average auto accident in the United States of America costs $1,835. That's your average auto wreck, $1,835. Now, you thought, oh, my God, I would have thought that the average car wreck is thousands and thousands of dollars. No, those are the exceptions. Fender benders occur all the time. Having an auto accident with a death involved or something like that's pretty rare, although there's 40,000 of them every year get killed. But there's, you know, bottom line, here's the numbers, $1,835. Now, let's apply a little what we call wisdom here, or common sense. Let's take the $800 a year. I plug that into my Sharp EL1197G. Now, let's ask the last question. As a licensed driver in America, so one of two, about 140 million Americans that have licenses in their pockets, out of 140 million Americans, can you tell me how many of you would expect to have an automobile accident this year? Well, the answer is about 1 million of you, or about 1 out of 140. About 1 out of 140. Now, the average automobile accident is going to be $1,835. Now, let's apply the numbers, put the numbers to this, which was very nicely done by the American Automobile Association. Thank you. Thank you very much for the numbers here. About how often would you expect, as an average automobile driver driving the average number of miles per year, which is 15,000 miles a year, how often would you expect to have one of these $1,835 accidents? And the answer is, you ready for this? Once every 32 years. Boys and girls, on average, once every 32 years, you are going to have an automobile accident. Now, I started driving when I was 16. I'll give you an illustration of how this works. And when I was 16, I started driving a car. And I'm pushing 70 right now, so let's take 70. Just round this off, 70. And then let's take 16 off of that, 54 years. So I've been driving cars now for 54 years. I've had two auto accidents. Neither one of them involved insurance. I never collected a dime off of the insurance. Both of the auto accidents that I had were not my fault. You know, when it was all said and done, it was somebody ran into me. And when it was all, so I didn't pay auto insurance all those years, but if I had paid, on average, I would have paid $800 a year. Adjusted for inflation, I would have paid $800 a year for 54 years. So let's take 800 times 54. I would have paid $43,200 over my lifetime of driving. And I would have never collected a dime off of the $43,200, which is exactly what the auto insurance industry wants me to do. And it's what they want you to do. Pay your premiums and collect nothing. Now, I'm kind of an exception to the rule. There's going to be an average here. And the average is once every 32 years, you could expect to have an automobile accident. All right, so once every 32 years, you're going to have an auto accident. Now, you're going to pay in for 32 years times $800, $25,600, and you're going to collect $1,835. So you get $25,600, and we're going to take away from that $1,835. So the insurance industry is going to make $23,765 off of you as an average. Is that a good value for you? Hell, I'd just soon be self-insured, which is what people used to do before we got off on the mandatory insurance kick some years back. In this state in 1976, our legislature came up with the idea that everybody has to have auto insurance. Actually, there's three ways that you can handle this. You can have auto insurance, or you can have a property bond, or you can have a group liability bond. Three ways for you to handle it. I prefer the property bond because then I don't have to pay the $800 a year. I'm self-insured, and so I have a piece of property over here, and I pledge the piece of property to the Department of Revenue of my state. And you can do this in your state also if you want. And that way, when you drive for 31 years and you don't have any accidents at all, you can pocket that $23,765, and then in the 24th year, the 32nd year, you have an accident, and on average, it'll cost you $1,835, and you reach in here into your $23,765, and you pull out the $1,835, and you go pay the guy that you ran into on average. And if everybody did that, the auto insurance industry would be out of business, wouldn't they? And then instead of us pouring all those billions and billions of dollars into the auto insurance industry, we'd have those same billions and billions of dollars that we could spend in the economy and buy things that we really need and could really have some good use for, couldn't we? Now, what do you think is the more reasonable, the more common sense solution to auto insurance, property bond or insurance? We could carry this out to the next step, and we could go on to health insurance. We could go on to fire insurance. Let's take a look at fire insurance. That's a good one. I did a little research on this one. In Boise, Idaho, I used to live in a house at 1205 North Roosevelt Street. I was four blocks from Joe Albertson up on the first bench, so therefore I'm living in the nicer neighborhoods. So I'm living up here in the nice neighborhood, and I live in one of these $100,000 houses. Back when a $100,000 house was a lot of money. You know, today a $100,000 house is a piece of trash. It's a Marin County fixer-upper. But, you know, there was a time when $100,000, you know, was a pretty splashy house. And there was 400 of these houses in my neighborhood. That is my neighborhood, you know, from Fairview down to Alert Orchard, and up to the next two streets. I can't think of their names now, but in this little area here, I counted the house. The reason I knew this is because my boy delivered newspapers in that neighborhood right there, and so we counted the houses, 400 houses. I said, Jesus, 400 houses. I wonder how much these people are paying in fire insurance, because I took a look at my fire insurance bill, and I said, ooh, times 400. Then I got to thinking. I said, well, how many fires do we have here in Boise every year? And how expensive are these fires here in Boise? And do we really need this fire insurance? Because if you go down and buy a house and you got a mortgage on your house, you have to have fire insurance. The bank insists upon it. See, the bank requires that you have fire insurance, and if you don't have fire insurance, they won't give you the mortgage. They won't do business with you. And so, like, I guess the banks and the insurance companies are kind of in bed together. You know, it's kind of a neat deal for the two of them. All right, so get your pen and paper out here, boys and girls. Sharpen your pencil on both ends. Let me give you the numbers here. Boise, Idaho, city of about, well, at that time when I did the numbers here, it was about 110,000. Last I heard, it was around 150,000. Capital of Idaho, Boise, you know, kind of a mid-sized town, about like Springfield, Missouri, 150 to 200,000 population in that neighborhood. All right, how many fires do you think occurred in Boise, Idaho? Well, the answer is one a week, about 50 a year. Well, how many houses do you think there are in Boise, Idaho? Well, taking the national average of four people per household and 100,000 people, about 25,000 houses in Boise, Idaho. So you get about 25,000 houses, about 100,000 people, round numbers, and have about one fire every week. All right. Now, when was the last time a house burned to the ground? 100% loss in the city of Boise. So I went to the fire department and asked them. We got down and we did our research, and 1957 was the last time that a house burned to the ground. So in my neighborhood, I took a look around, and we had four fire departments within six blocks of my house. Four fire departments. Now, of course, one of them is my fire district. But, you know, in a pinch, they could have got the fire company up on Fairview, or the fire company up on Orchard, or the fire company down on Americana. And then there was another one on the other side of the river. Just, you know, they're different districts, but just where my house was located. And I said, wow, you talk about fire protection now. Now, by the way, all this fire protection is paid for by us taxpayers. So when I pay my property taxes, I'm paying for this fire engine and the guys to stay down here in the firehouse. Now, every one of these firehouses has some full-time employees. They're called firemen. And these guys get paid every day. They don't do anything. Well, we're not putting out fires every day because we only have one fire a week. And I don't know. I didn't add this up. But how many fire stations did we have in Boise? Well, four of them were within six blocks of my house. And then Boise is a pretty good-sized town. I would have guessed probably 12 fire stations in our city. I think 12 would be a reasonable conservative number. 12, it might be 20, but you know, I know there's going to be 10 or 12. All right, so we got 12. And let's say there's, you know, you got to have somebody on duty here 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, don't you? I don't know how many guys are in these fire stations, but I'm going to guess that there's two on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that's at least six guys, 2, 4, 6 every day. And then they only work 5 days a week. So, you know, you got to have another pair for the weekends. That's eight. So there's eight guys at least per fire station. And there's 10 fire stations, so that's 80 guys. So the fire department in Boise, Idaho, has to be at least 100 people. All right, so you got these 100 guys, and we pay our property taxes, and they got to have fire stations, and they got to have fire engines, and all the accoutrements that go with it. And now here's where I'm going with this. Because what's the average loss to a house fire in Boise, Idaho? As of, well, when I did this, it was about 1985. And the answer to that little riddle was $14,000. Average loss. It's called a kitchen fire, grease fire in the kitchen. You're going to lose $14,000. Now, you got a $100,000 house, and so everybody has to insure the house for its full value, $100,000, and pay the premium on $100,000. But when the fire occurs, on average, you're only going to have a $14,000 fire. So if you insure your house for $14,000, which you can't do because the bank won't let you do that under your mortgage contract, but if you own the house free and clear, you could. You could buy $14,000 worth of insurance. That's 14%. Now, your house catches on fire, and you have a $14,000 fire. Do you think the fire insurance company is going to pay you $14,000? No, sir. They're going to pay you 14% of $14,000, which is, we'll put in 14,000 times 0.14, which is $1,960 less your $500 deductible. About $1,460. That's what you're going to get paid. Now, you carry $100,000 worth of insurance on your house. They require you to carry full insurance on the house. But they know that the average fire is only going to be $14,000. Furthermore, they know that there's only going to be 52 of these fires per year. So let's take 25,000 houses, times, and I would spend $400 a year, which is, Teresa, $10 million a year. So let's take $10 million, and you put that over here in column A, that's $10 million. Now we got 52 fires times $14,000, which is $728,000. So for every dollar the fire insurance company takes in, they're going to pay out 7.28 cents. Hey, ain't that just real special? Huh? You pay them a dollar, they pay out 7 cents. And then they make, you know, 90 plus cents profit. Now, that's a pretty profitable business. So I got to thinking about that, and I said, geez, I think I'll get into the fire insurance business. And so I got the Gordon Fire Insurance Company, and I insure my own house. I'm self-insured. Been here 25 years. Here's where we're at, 25 times $400, not adjusted for inflation, is $10,000. So I got $10,000 in my fire insurance fund. And I haven't had a fire in 25 years, and I won't have another fire. You know, your chances of having a fire in your house, let's just figure it out in any particular year. We got 52 fires, and we're going to divide that by 25,000 houses, okay? Your chances of having a fire are 0.00208 per year. I mean, boys and girls, your chances of having a fire are pretty darn poor. And you know, when we take a look at auto insurance, fire insurance, health insurance, you know, you're paying $10,000 a year for health insurance. You know that in 10 years' time, you could have $100,000. And do you know if you've practiced the health laws of the Bible, you wouldn't get sick? And you could put $100,000 in the bank in 10 years and never get sick. I don't get sick. I don't have cancer. I don't have heart attack. Somebody's going to say, well, you never know. I do. You don't, might not know, but I do. I don't eat pig. I don't eat fat. I don't eat blood. And where did I get that? Well, because the Bible told me. That's called revelation. See, by looking at revelation, and I'm not talking about the book of Revelation, I'm talking about the revelation in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. My creator, my designer, said, hey, Gordon, let me tell you, I designed your body, and here's the kind of fuel that you need to burn in it. I got my Ford manual out here, and they said, hey, Gordon, the kind of fuel that you should put in your Ford pickup is. And I follow the Ford company's recommendations, and I burn the kind of fuel that they recommend in their Ford pickup. And you know that my Ford pickup runs just real good. I haven't tested it with diesel, and that's because it's a gas engine. And I figured that if I follow the manufacturer's instruction handbook, I'll probably be better off. I did that with my body, and you know that works. And that's what I call common sense. You know, nothing big about it. Now, a lot of people are out here eating pig, and they're eating fat, and they're eating blood. They're experimenting. They're finding out whether or not they can eat fat, blood, and pig, and whether or not they can live their lives to 70 years without getting a heart attack and stroke and cancer and so on. And that's reinventing the wheel. That's already been tested over and over and over and over again. And my common sense just says to me, that's not very wise to keep reinventing the wheel. Now, cancer has a cause, and pig-eating Christians have been experimenting for hundreds of years, eating fat, eating blood, and eating pig, and they get sick. And then they pray to Jesus, and then Jesus doesn't answer because they're pig-eating Christians, and then they die from cancer. And then they run around wringing their hands, saying, oh, I can't understand why God would let poor old Roy die. I just can't connect the dots. Can't figure it out. And that's why I said, I think that America is deficient in wisdom, commonly known as common sense. I'm out of time. I got to leave it right there, boys and girls. We'll take this up again next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. But let me remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package to order yours. Just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.